What's up, everybody? Welcome to Mike Dawes Has a Podcast. My name is Mike Dawes, and I do, in fact, have a podcast. Joining me on this journey are the good people at Tonewood Amp. The Tonewood Amp is the amazing guitar gadget that sticks to the back surface of your acoustic guitar and vibrates reverbs, delays, and other loveliness through the sound hole as if by magic. Because why should electric guitar players have all the fun? To find out more about the Tonewood Amp and to get a very special discount, head to MikeDawesHasAPodcast.com and try one out for yourself. This show is all about guitar, guitarists, and the music industry in general. I'm really excited to catch up with some friends who I've met on the road over the years, and I'm honored to share some conversations with some really exciting guests I'll be meeting for the first time. Be sure to follow all the guests on their socials, as well as Tonewood Amp and myself, by typing things into the internet. And do remember to leave a review of the podcast so we continue making more. Thanks very much, guys. Let's dive right into it. Uncle John Gom is in the house, ladies and gentlemen. It is so good to see you, man. How have you been?
Okay. All right. Up and down, you know.
Lots of day drinking?
I've actually stopped drinking for the past few weeks, which sounds really good and pious, but the only reason I've done that is because I thought I was drinking too much, just out of... just a constant state of low-level stress from living in a pandemic, really. What about you?
Yeah, well, I say that because last time we spoke, that's what we were talking about. Last time I spoke to you was sort of as the pandemic first started. And I think that's pretty much where we were both at. I mean, here in the UK... Yeah, it's been a while.
God, that sucks.
Here in the UK, for anyone listening outside, it's pretty weird. We're in month whatever of lockdown number whatever, I don't know. So we haven't really... seen our mates or been anywhere, as has pretty much the majority of the world, to be honest. But it is nice to connect with you again, man, and congratulations on the new album, which is freaking fantastic. How has the reception been? Are you stoked?
I mean, it's strange because it's been quite intangible. Everything's online, all that kind of reaction, but it's been really great in terms of people saying how much they like the music, and that's all I can really ask for, you know. And people saying that they're having like an emotional connection with it, which is all I crave. I mean, all I want to do and all I've wanted to do for a long time is kind of just reach inside people and have a rummage and twist things about a bit and try and just change them and how they feel for a minute. And that's all I want to do. And it's odd because, like, when you do that live on a stage, the feeling is incredibly visceral and really overwhelming sometimes, and can be can completely change you as well. It's like really, it's really a lot. And doing it on the internet is not quite the same, and can sometimes, it's the same as everybody. You know, we can't see each other, so we're doing this, and this can make you feel like, I mean, we never did this before, and this can make you feel more apart. Do you know what I mean?
Because I totally get it. And everything you're just saying is super relevant to a couple of the previous conversations I've had on these podcasts, because, you know, I was talking to Andy, you know, McKee, our mutual friend, and also Danish Pete from the Andertons kind of channel over the past couple of weeks. And we were both on both of those sessions talking about, I guess, trying to quantify the difference in during the pandemic, the difference between putting out a song and a piece of art and the pressure to put out just content, right? And at the core of it all is that emotional connection, like you say, that we as both of, you know, you and I have been live performers. That's what we do since I've known you. You know, I mean, back when I was doing open mic nights in 2007 in pubs in Guildford, you know, there was people saying, hey, you should check out this guy, John Gom, you know, back when you had shoulder length hair, you know. Playing these amazing tunes, amazing singer-songwriter fingerstyle stuff, and I completely relate, man. It's different, isn't it? I mean, we've both done live streaming gigs as well, which are a different thing. I mean, how was that for you? Did you enjoy that?
Oh, they were amazing. Yeah, I really, really, really loved it. I really loved it. It was scary, especially at the start, and then I kind of eased into it. It was just scary because it's like when you do live radio, for example, and you can't see anybody who's out there and you're playing and you know that there's loads of people listening. But I don't know, I just need the reassurance of being able to look them in the eye and also them to see me. So it's, yeah, it's different, but I really, really loved it. And people were really kind of, you know, enthusiastic and really wanted to be there. And a lot of times it's people who've been coming to see you for years who will go to those things. So you do already have a little bit of a connection with those people. So I found it really positive and nice.
Nice to see some sort of familiar names in the chat. You know, people you recognize. Lots of Germans.
I have my brother monitoring the chat so that I didn't have to be kind of checking constantly. And then he would actually text me because I had everything that was kind of internet stuff in my house turned off so that nothing could impede the
no one
the
watching
stream,
Netflix
people were paying
in another
money,
room.
You know, exactly. Yeah. So, my brother was literally SMS texting me highlights from the chat.
Yeah.
And that was really funny because I was appealing for, you know, heckles and people.
Of course, you want
the
banter.
In my first video related to the fact that I did my first live stream in black and white because I'm just, I'm just very pretentious.
It's a black and white. It's a black and white theme. Look at the record. I've got it right here. The faintest
idea.
Yeah,
it is.
You know,
all my videos are black and white at the moment. Oh, it's nice.
It's so beautiful. Thank you so much for sending that out. Yeah, this is it. I just want to keep talking so the Zoom chat thing video flicks to me. If you're listening to the audio version, you can
hop on over
to YouTube and check it out.
There's a deluxe edition, which is like super duper 12-inch hardback book, and it's really incredible. It's because I have a record label that I'm working with now that I've never done before. I've always been completely independent. And what I found is the main difference is that they have pushed me to do things that I would never have dared to do before, like some amazing expensive, well, it's 40 pounds. So
yeah,
to me, that's like, I'm worried if people want to pay that much, you know, because I don't think that I'm really worth
this is what I love about
you, know what I mean?
This is one of the things that I've always loved about you, because we've known each other for a long time, and we've gigged, you know, I've opened for you, and we've gigged together all over the world, really, from, you know, alleyways in Bath, you know, UK, to, you know, the Austrian mountains at Thomas's boot camp. And it's the humility, which I think people really, really, this natural humility that you have, that people really engage with. And I see it in the comments, you know, when you're creating a piece of music and you put it out there, this is a carefully constructed piece of art, and people are able to tell the difference. I often go to your videos to read comments, actually, from, you know, mutual friends, boot campies, you know, people like this, like Matt Midgley, if he's listening, people like that. And the way people engage with your content is, and I say content because it's freaking 2021.
Don't say,
you know,
content.
It's just in the vocabulary now. But the way people engage with it is on that deeper level. And I always get this sense of reassurance in my own creative pursuits when I see something like that, because I'm bombarded by these, you know, I don't know, content versus art, you know, constantly, as we all are today, not being able to see our friends leave the house, go on tour, engage with actual audiences. And I see that deeper connection in the response to a lot of these recent videos and tunes that you've been putting out. So thank you for keeping the flame going for instrumental musicians just taking their time with an art piece and cooking it until it's ready and putting it out and creating that emotional connection. Really, it really means a lot. And I say that because this is your first album in quite a long time, right?
It is. It is. I've had a lot of life stuff to deal with. So it's caused me to progress in a different way, where I'm just not thinking so much about... everything's all about the reason that I'm writing a piece of music now and nothing else. And that's all that matters, either writing or arranging or performing or whatever. It's all about why am I doing this? And that is a question that everybody should ask. And I've been encouraging people to do that for a long time, but in more of a kind of, okay, if you're composing a song, what's it about? That's the first thing I want to know. What's it about? If you don't know what it's about, then you're going to struggle with your kind of direction, motivation. It doesn't need to be about, you know, your mom or... you know, a nice tree that you once saw, or a relationship breakup, or it doesn't need to be about something specific in that way. It could just be about, I'm trying to create something beautiful in a particular way. But you need to have like an end, some kind of end result, not an end result of what the music's going to sound like, just what's the point of it? What's somebody going to get out of it? What's the you know, do they just want to dance to it? That could be it. You know, it can be something really simple, but it could be some emotional thing you want to communicate. And now I've even kind of gone beyond that, where the music itself becomes something which just becomes an extension of that, which is sounds really, really pretentious, but it's just what has occurred. It's just
here,
what's
here
occurred.
I am saying how humble.
Yeah, it's just, well, I don't know. It's not really a lot about humility. It's just more like, okay, if something happens in your life which is traumatic and, like, you know, I've suffered loss of like, my best friend took his own life a couple of years ago.
I'm sorry.
And it was really, really shocking and traumatic, and I'll never get over it. And he was a busker primarily, so there's one of his songs on the album. I've rearranged it. He used to play a couple of my songs, you know, on the streets.
Oh, nice. Which songs?
He used to play Gloria, and then he used to do my version of High and Dry, which I taught him to play. So I used to give him guitar lessons. He was called Johnny Walker, like the whiskey, and he's a really amazing songwriter. So I did one of his songs for the new album. And when you have something like that, it's like you're not thinking about anything except the person that and the experience. You can't. It fills your whole head. You can't think. So, you know, when you're thinking about what note you're going to choose, it's always completely in service of something which feels really important. In the same way that, like, I mean, I would never do this. I'm not a religious guy, but it makes me think of like the way that Bach used to write, and everything was in service of his religion and of his God, you know. And it's like, it's not that this makes him super important. He wasn't trying to be, oh, I'm Bach. I mean, he was just some guy organist, you know what I mean? But he was just paying respect to something. And that's what I don't know. That's kind of what I'm doing a bit.
I totally get it. And, you know, this is something that's, it's almost particularly relevant in instrumental music. I mean, obviously you are, you know, you're known as a, you know, world-class guitar virtuoso, but you're a singer-songwriter as well, so you are able to convey that extra layer.
I can do literally nothing else, though. So that's it. So that sounds like, oh, wow, it's two things, but that's it, two things.
Well, dude, I've got
I
one thing.
I cannot do anything
I've got
else.
One thing, come on. I sing in the shower and in the car, and yeah, my mum thinks I have a great voice, but she's wrong.
I bet you have other talents that I don't know about, though.
You'd be surprised.
I want to say something
so
dirty right now. I know you do.
We can talk after the recording ends. But with the instrumental thing, you know, when you don't have the lyrics as well, you know, I do a lot of talks about, or answer a lot of questions, I should say, about composition and arrangement. That's something that instrumental guitar players get a lot. You know, how do I arrange? How do I write on a solo instrument? Blah, blah, blah. And that is such an important thing to convey, you know, the message. What is it? What is it about? My last album, or I did a live album, but my last studio album, Era, like every song is about something really, really important. And that's why it took me, you know, 4 or 5 years to write the thing, because those moments of inspiration come, they come when they come, you know, and it's very hard to force it. And I feel like there's this extra pressure nowadays, especially being both of us touring musicians off the road, forced off the road, this kind of pressure to write more. And honestly, man, the one song, I mean, I love the tune, but the one song that I wrote which wasn't about anything is probably like my least popular song, you know what I mean?
Okay.
And the songs that have this extra thing behind them. I mean, you know,
do you know what
you
I
know,
tell people? I mean, I'm going to Uncle John you now, but you know, I haven't told you off yet. It's bound to happen before the end of the podcast. But I am now going to give you advice.
Oh, please, Uncle John. By the way, we should definitely tell people that we are in fact related, and you are actually my real Uncle John.
Yeah, so I wonder whose sibling that would make me. I don't think I've ever met your parents, though, which is really sad.
Yeah, it's a strange relationship.
So what I was going to say was, sometimes you know, I worry when I tell people, oh, your music's got to be about something, because maybe they just wrote, a lot of people do, they write instrumental stuff, and it's just because they're noodling and they come up with a sound and then they end up writing a piece.
Right.
And they haven't really thought about what it's about. But that doesn't mean it doesn't sound good and it's not worth playing. And I always say to them, okay, well, you can apply something retrospectively. You can apply meaning retrospectively. That's what your listeners are going to do. Like, it doesn't matter. If I play a piece of music to somebody without telling them what it's about, they're not going to think of exactly the same thing that it was about. You know, they're going to come up with their own meaning. So now you can do that. Listen to it as a listener. Find your own meaning in it. But once you find it, you know, whatever it is, Really invest in that and really, really believe that. And then you'll be able to deliver a different experience to people when they listen to it. And also you won't get bored of playing it in the same way. So this is another real value, you know, to that.
Of course. Yeah, of course. I mean, and some of, that's why the best songs in the world, songs, you know, with vocal, with message that could be interpreted completely literally, should not be interpreted completely literally, you know? That's yeah, the beauty of lyrics, you know, of course. But yeah, I mean, you know that, you know, the tunes that I have that tend to be the ones that take off are the ones that have clearly sort of, say, something super emotional has happened in say the private life, and then you get that tunnel vision of inspiration where you can't do anything else other than just pick up the guitar and play, and and then the song kind of creates itself. That's more what I'm talking about. You know, I'm finding it incredibly difficult right now to find the inspiration to pick up the guitar and write. You know, until something traumatic happens. I say traumatic, that's a bit of an easy out. It's not always traumatic. Just something significant. Just stuff. A significant event. An example for myself being Eddie Van Halen passing away, right? I had a half cover done for ages, but then when that happened, all I could do was pick up and play. And I hadn't played guitar for months because of the
pandemic.
I remember
you told me, last summer you hadn't really been playing,
And just yesterday, somebody sent me a link to a YouTuber, I can't remember his name, Michael something, like one, he's like, does reaction videos. You know?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he did like a reaction to that. And all the stuff he was picking up on was exactly that. It was exactly the correct intent. And props to this guy. Sorry, I can't recall his last name, but it's on YouTube. I thought it was really almost nice to get that feedback of this energy that has been put out there that I haven't been able to get yet because of no gigs, you know?
Okay,
You know what I mean? So when you get that kind of feedback, it's really rewarding on a much deeper level than something like likes and comments, you know, which is kind of
It's really great, that arrangement. I messaged you after you did it. I remember there was a certain bit which I was thinking, I wonder if he's going to include that bit or not. I think it's the bit with the really fast keyboard runs after the...
the little arpeggios, the synth arpeggios.
Yeah, they're beautiful. I think it's like my favourite moment of the song.
Oh, thanks,
anyway,
man.
But obviously you did include it. And we both know Eric Roach, who did a version of that, which was kind of part of the fingerstyle canon.
Exactly, yeah. I was playing that arrangement, Eric's arrangement, at open mic nights around Guildford, which is obviously where he lived and taught. For anyone who is listening and doesn't know Eric Roach, because... you know, perhaps you're young or not from the UK or not deep into the fingerstyle history.
Definitely, you know. Irish, so just careful.
Okay, I'm sorry.
But he definitely was like the biggest influence on the British Isles fingerstyle scene, yeah.
Yeah,
but
well, I grew up with his influence around Guildford, which is where he taught as well. I know he's not from there, but obviously he taught Newton Faulkner, who was the first guest on this podcast, and many other people. So his influence permeates the entire scene, and it's actually how I got connected with Nick Benjamin and the boot camp, which is kind of the spiritual home of the fingerstyle scene up in the Alps.
Yeah, and also Eric did the boot camp. So Eric Roach had his kind of acoustic guitar boot camp, and after he passed away, Thomas started his boot camp instead. There's people who were going to Eric's who are still going now. Yeah. So, you know, Thomas has been going for, I don't know, 16 years, 70, a long time. But there's people who've been going longer than that from when Eric started it. And Eric was obviously an amazing, amazing guitar player. He kind of introduced a lot of us over here to the kind of post-Hedges extended techniques, lots of tapping and harmonics and different tunings. And he introduced a lot of people to that over here. But he did an arrangement of Jump. But, I mean, you've taken it to a different place. But there is also something about your playing which reminds me of his playing, in that you've always got this slight Celtic sound inside everything you do. And it's even if you're not playing anything that's even vaguely Celtic, there's just some way you approach.
It's in Dadgad. Well, there is that. And it's major. Okay, like what do you got? 2-4? 0-2-4? 0-2-4?
You live in and around Dadgad a lot, but it's like... but no, there's more than that. It's the way that you use slurs rather than tapping as such.
Right.
So you do use tapping as well, but I mean specifically slurs, where you play a note and there's a dynamic of a struck note and then a hammer-on or then a pull-off, and they have a very different timbre. And that's so Celtic to have that little rolling sound. And it's inside like everything you do. And the way you attack the strings, where you get really, really quiet sometimes, the way you attack the strings. Your dynamic goes really scarily quiet. Your recording equipment's got to be very, 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 very good. Because, any noise and it would be RX. Ruined. So, there is that. It doesn't hurt. But, it's that subtlety and just that there's a lilting quality. Even when you're pounding out a rock classic, there's still a lilting Celtic quality.
A lilting quality.
There is. I think it's a mixture of Eric and Pierre Bensouzan.
Well, that's it.
And
I was just going to say those are the two influences. Yeah.
And
McManus.
It's the lockdown. Yeah, Tony McManus. Thank you. How did you see? You knew exactly who I was going to say. I didn't even hint.
This is the genius of the gong. Yeah. He's able to just pinpoint really relatively obscure influences in the grand scheme of the music and guitar world. Well, I appreciate that, devices, different attacks as you know, when you're playing completely instrumentally and completely exposed on the top line. Something I'm always trying to emphasize to people that I teach or do clinics or whatever is you know, a vocalist isn't starting every syllable, every word of a melody with the letter T, you know.
The detail you put in is really, really extraordinary, and it's further than I go, but I tend to get more complicated in terms of like more multiple things happening at the same time, and you lose that ability sometimes to have that really intricate, right, how am I going to attack every note, because I'm just
you're also playing on telegraph pole wire on your strings.
that doesn't really make a big difference, but I'm a different kind of player for sure. Yeah.
Oh, dude, it's incredible stuff, and obviously I've been a fan forever, and we've played, you know, back when I first started, I was living in Hampshire, and my mum was running a very small theatre in a little village town called Borden in Hampshire, and I remember we had you over.
The
Phoenix Theatre. Shout out to the Phoenix Theatre in Borden, not the Exeter Phoenix. But we had Thomas over. Thomas Lee.
Not the Exeter. Not the Exeter Phoenix.
The
Who
Borden,
do they think they
the
are?
Borden
they stole
Phoenix.
Your name. They stole your name.
Exactly. There's only one 75 seat theatre in the south.
It's a lovely, lovely little theatre. That I remember a gig totally. I remember it. Yeah. I remember it was like maybe like the first or one of the. It was one of the really earliest times that I played Passion Flower. But I think they hadn't released the video, but it hadn't gone viral. But you guys had heard it. Yeah. And I said, oh, I'm not sure whether to play it. I have this new song. I'm not sure whether to play it, especially to your very nice. They were quite kind of middle class, quite nice, well-to-do audience. And I was thinking, are they going to really like a 7-minute prog epic in Lydian?
Man. You lilted through it. It was great.
But now it's my hit. So,
dude, it was. I remember that specifically. And actually, I will correct your history a little bit based on my memory, because that, I believe, was another gig we played at the Chapel Arts Centre in Bath. And I say that because...
I don't know, you could be right, but I do remember that. That was like there was almost nobody there.
The chapel, it was that one. It was that one, that was like pretty barren. But I remember that because I think you had just released the video, but it hadn't gone viral. But I remember you saying it was one of the first times you were playing it. I remember loving it because you'd made a point to myself and my ex, who I was playing with at the time. You made a point of saying that this is your new song and everything, and we were totally blown away by it. And we knew like this is a thing. This is not just another song. This is something special. Another thing I remember about that gig was I had been suffering from tendonitis for like ages.
Forgot about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I couldn't play guitar for almost a year. God. But what happened was this was one of my first gigs back, and I played a song called Boogie Shred, which is an old song of mine. And bear in mind, I was terrified about my hands. I remember doing one of these percussive hits on the cutaway, and I cut my finger open and blood was spraying out. So it was a particularly memorable gig for a few reasons, as well as obviously...
I don't remember that.
Yeah.
I guess I was probably backstage when, I don't know, getting ready to play. I don't know. That's really weird. I don't remember that. I remember you having tendonitis and you being obviously really concerned about it. Yeah, my God.
Well, I remember because I'm colorblind and I thought it was chocolate. Under the stage lights, I couldn't see. I thought, oh, I got chocolate all over my hand. But we must talk about passion
flower. Have you
been
eating chocolate?
No, but what's a thing that happens? What's more logical? You know, sometimes chocolate ends up on your guitar. I don't know. But we got to talk about passion flower, Matt, because obviously that's like a mega guitar song. I would say that you got classical gas, then you got drifting, and then you got passion flower.
No, come on.
No, dude.
Fuck off.
Dude, fuck you.
Fuck off.
Dude, come on with your accent, you good man. No, I say this because it's a little bit different because
there's
vocals. I would
say you've got Beethoven's Fifth, Mike, Beethoven's Fifth. Then you've got like Sgt. Pepper's, and then you've got Passion Flower. Yeah. That's basically how it goes. Everything else, pointless, waste of time.
What I'm saying is awareness of the guitar as something more than the you know, everyday person would perceive the guitar as. I know before drifting, classical gas was this thing. Then drifting was this thing by Andy, obviously, and we talked about that on the episode with Andy. But Passion Flower particularly was on my radar, obviously, because we played together, but also because, you know, you had British institution Stephen Fry talking about it. Now, for anyone outside of the UK who doesn't know who Stephen Fry is, you should. How did he... Because I remember seeing him talk about it on The One Show, which very mainstream British kind of every day at 6 p.m. or whatever TV program.
Yeah, he just tweeted it, and it was back in the day when people thought that that was like, you know, the everything. If you got tweeted by a celebrity, you know.
Yeah, but, back when the algorithm permitted such spread of morality.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, when it was actually... Yeah, kind of. If something went viral, it was an organic thing, which doesn't really happen so much now.
Because you've got to pay the tech companies the fund dollars. Yeah,
yeah. Although I think Facebook has a lot to do with the reason that different things go viral now, because it doesn't really lend itself to watching a full. People don't go on Facebook to watch music. They don't do that. So certainly not a whole song.
But it's where people still discover things, you know,
it's very strange. Stephen Fry, everyone knows him. He's like in The Hobbit, you know.
It's probably not what he's most famous for, but sure.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it is. But he's, so he tweeted it and then he went on this like super primetime middle of the road national TV show, which is the most boring fucking TV show I've ever. It's like just some old guy doing like a 4 minute piece on location about like some sewing factory that has been shut down 50 years ago. It's really, but it's quite reassuring and quite nice to watch. But anyway, he went on that and they talked about on that. I remember I was doing a bit of teaching at the Guitar Institute in London. And I was in one of my favourite cafes in the whole world, just near there. And I just got a phone call from somebody at the BBC saying, I'm calling from The One Show. Is it okay if we use some of your video? And I just said, yeah, of course. So they did. And I went on BBC Breakfast, which is the kind of top-rated national breakfast, you know, news current affairs, whatever thing. And it's funny because in the UK, because there's so little music on TV, which I think is true everywhere, except for talent shows, you know, it's actually, there's one music show called Jules Holland, which is the top rated one that you can get on. And then the second rated one that you can get on is BBC Breakfast, because it's one of the few outlets for musicians to ever go on and like play or perform or just have a conversation or anything.
That's interesting. I didn't know it was so popular for music because I'm never ever up that early.
I don't know if it's popular for music. It's just, it's one of the very, very few outlets, you know, like local news. Yeah, I went on the local news and they'll have you on. And it's a bit like that. It's a little bit like a local news program, but it's national. So
did you have to sort of get there at like 3 a.m. for makeup and all of that?
Yeah, it was bad. It was really bad. I remember they wouldn't pay for Tash, my wife, who was my manager for many, many years, they wouldn't pay for her train fare. So and I was really broke, you know, so we had to pay for her train fare, which was a real pain. But they did pay for my train fare and a very cheap hotel. And I had to be there really early. Who was there backstage? There was Chris Evans, the actor.
Not the Captain. Oh, the Captain America, Chris
Captain
Evans.
America was there.
Oh, right on.
And he tweeted about me afterwards and said how much he liked it. And there was a famous chef there who was really, really angry, but I got the feeling he was kind of always angry.
Gordon Ramsay.
I forgot his name, though. No. Not comedy angry, just really, like, just pissed off.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Gordon Ramsay, I think, is probably a fairly nice guy, but then he just gets really mad for the cameras, you know.
Yeah.
I absolutely love Ramsay's Kitchen Nightmares USA. Oh, my God, I've watched every single episode of that. It is incredible. It's
amazing.
So good. Yeah, but it was really... I've went on a talk show in Brazil, which has like 20 million people watch that. They spelled my name wrong on the screen.
Oh, really? How do they spell with an H?
I don't even remember now. And I got there and they'd made my artwork from my album at the time, which is stuff that I'd drawn myself.
Just like
and
this,
and they'd animated
by the way,
it.
Just like this, so anyone on the YouTube version can see.
Oh, no, that's not... That's my... I didn't draw that.
Oh, not
I,
like
I
that,
I wish.
Then.
I
not
wish.
Not like that.
No, on my previous album, and Secrets Nobody Keeps, it was called, and they
the
take and
one.
I drew a little painting for each song, and they're very basic, so I can't really paint, and they turned it into an animation on this one of the biggest video screens I've ever seen in my life. They'd animated all of these artworks that I'd done. They didn't ever ask me for any materials for that, so I don't know how they even done it really. And then they showed me where I had to play, and it was this gantry about 20 feet really, really high and about that wide, and it was like I can't fit on there with my pedals and stuff,
because this
and
was a live performance, or was it
I've never used any backing tracks or anything like that.
I've
never done that.
It was like,
but I think it was live. I think the recording of the music was, and I've done this a couple of times where you do an interview live and then you stand up and walk off as if you're going to go and then play, but actually they pre-record the playing bit.
Yeah. I was talking to Kaki King on another episode, and she was talking about doing Letterman.
It was terrifying. It's terrifying. I don't know how she found it. I mean, she was
well,
a lot
she
younger
said it was cold.
The time.
She said it was the whole studio was frozen.
God.
So and she had to leave
how,
the guitar
how can they
out
do
there.
That?
Yeah, yeah. And also
they, how,
it's
what?
Yeah, apparently they let you do another take if you want, but you shouldn't because there's such a huge production that it's like you feel like a bit of an ass if you have to do it again. You know what I mean? Because everything's
pitch
crash bosh.
Yeah, I know that, but that's the thing where having been in that situation, I very much feel like okay, this is. I am kind of small fry. I am just a cog in the wheel. But also, I've never been on this show before. I've never done this before, and I may well never ever do it again. And so, I'm going to treat this like this is kind of more important for me than it is for the camera guy who does it every single day.
Sure.
And not in like an egotistical way, just in a like I've got to get through this somehow kind of a way. And like I remember before that one in Brazil, a woman came backstage in my changing room with an iron and an ironing board and just looks me up and down. And it was like, you better iron your fucking clothes, you fucking slob. And it was really bad.
That's amazing.
I did one in Portugal with a really wonderful comedian.
See,
who does
I
Uncle.
Think this is I was getting confused because you were talking about Brazil. I thought that was the Portuguese one. I think I've seen the Portuguese one, but not the.
It was so funny. This guy who was really into like he spoke perfect English. It's called Herman Jose, and he was like a bit of a stand-up kind of vibe, and he did little sketch bits as well where he'd often be in drag. And then he would occasionally ask me, hey, Joe, because they'd be talking and in Portuguese, and occasionally he would just look to me and just say, oh, John, everything okay? And my booking agent had just taught me one phrase, which was, yo entiendo tudo, which means I understand everything. That's all I would say. I just sat there saying, I understand everything. And that's
amazing.
That's it.
Amazing.
But it was fun. I remember that one. They changed the filming date for me, which I didn't know about. I didn't know that had happened. But just because of the dates I was there, they'd had to change it for me. And there was this quite famous Fado singer, Fado being the traditional music of Portugal. And she was really, really pissed off. It was apparently her birthday that day, and she'd had a party organised that she had to get off to. And apparently we got delayed from filming my music bit, which wasn't because of anything I'd done, just because they had to set up and get the audience in. And she, honestly, I thought, why does this woman, who I've never spoken to, seemingly hate my guts?
Wow.
That's why. I just didn't know.
Yeah.
So the world of celebrity is not one that I am cut out for.
Well, hello there, everyone. Apologies for the interruption to the podcast, but I did want to tell you about the amazing Tonewood amp, the awesome sponsors of the show. Many of you will know already that I use this thing all the time, the magical little device that sticks with magnets to the back of your acoustic guitar, vibrates the back surface of the instrument so that reverb, delay, chorus, Leslie speaker effects, and other loveliness project out of the sound hole as if by magic. You can head to MikeDawsHasAPodcast.com now to get more information about the Tonewood amp, as well as saving a tasty percentage for yourself. Let's get right back to it.
Yeah, well, you know what? That's what keeps you humble and keeps you honest. And that's what people hear in your music, man. And I can see it in the comments, really, sincerely. So with Passion Flower, obviously sales of banjo tuners went through the roof, presumably.
Yeah, I guess. Most of them to Alex Misko. I think he bought them all.
I got a couple. I got on a guitar over there.
Yeah. How are you getting on with those? Oh no, we should talk about that separately because they might be sucking, and we don't want to say this brand sucks.
Well, here's the thing: that particular guitar that has the banjo tuners on,
because it's the black one.
Yeah, because it's the pandemic, and you know, I was like, let's get a guitar to experiment with. I haven't played much, and I haven't played much for the reasons that we already discussed. So, well, I say I haven't played much. I haven't played it enough to have an opinion as to whether I like it or not. So what John and I are referring to is there's a couple of different... So we should backtrack a bit for anyone that doesn't know what we're talking about at all, which is that on the song Passion Flower, there's a lot of crazy tuning change stuff. And the way to facilitate that is through these...
Perfect pitch, Mike.
Oh, sorry.
Just say perfect pitch.
Yes. And it's all one take and perfect pitch, and yes, absolutely. It's locking tuners, right? But anyway.
Yeah, so it's locking tuners. I am convinced in my memory, I don't know if I implanted this in myself. No, I'm convinced I saw Billy Connolly do it on TV. So Billy Connolly, the famous Scottish comedian who's very famous in America as well in the 90s. And he was a banjo player, and I'm convinced that I saw him do it on TV. And was like, what the hell is going on there? So it's this retuning trick using what banjo players generally call Scruggs pegs, after Earl Scruggs, who kind of invented the concept in the 50s. And you just tune it to a high note, lock a little key, and then tune it to a low note and lock a little key, and it won't move outside those two stops most of the time. They're not very reliable. But and then I saw Adrian Legg do it. I was well aware of him doing it. And it was really when I saw Nick Harper, who's an amazing English singer-songwriter and virtuoso, kind of, he's like an acoustic shredder, I would say. That's going to give people the wrong vibe.
It's more like punk rock kind of energy.
You should hear him. You should hear him, like, flat pick. He's unbelievable.
Oh yeah, I saw him at the guitar show, the London Guitar Show, one year we were there together, and he's an amazing
guitar player.
Yeah,
and he's an absolute hero to me, and he's like my sporting hero. So like, if I was to meet, you know, Steven Gerrard or one of the great, you know, football players from like Liverpool's past or something, I'd be really, I have met one or two, and I've been really, really overwhelmed. And it's the same with Nick. I feel very overwhelmed just by his prowess. It's like, this is like the ultimate kind of example. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's you know, an alpha, not an alpha male, just like an alpha musician or something. Do you know what I mean? And so he uses the locking tuning pegs, and it's after I saw him, and I was really getting into the solo acoustic thing at that time. So that's when I bought a couple, and I could only afford two because they're really expensive, the ones that I use. And then
you were using the Bill Keith ones.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So I use, they're called Keith pegs, and they're sold just by one website called Beacon Banjo. And Bill Keith, great banjo virtuoso himself who made these pegs. He sadly passed away a few years ago, but his son, Martin, is carrying on the company, still making the pegs. And they are like $130 each. They're really expensive for a tuning peg. Like your average tuning peg, like top level professional guitar tuning peg, is like $13. So like 10 times the price. But they are extraordinary. And yeah, so those became, I guess, it took a while before I saw somebody then doing something with them a lot, you know, in the fingerstyle world. But Alex Misko is certainly the one that I've seen the most.
Yeah,
he's
been, yeah.
Like his Careless Whisper cover.
Yeah.
For example, where he's doing so much retuning and stuff and really, really cool, incredibly technically complex. And yeah, so that's really cool. If that becomes kind of a part of the guitar canon, I guess that's really cool, yeah.
Yeah, it I think it is. And actually, I was on the phone to our good friend Petri Sariola from Finland.
Is he okay?
Yeah. He's building a studio in Finland right now, and I guess getting cracking on a bunch of albums. Actually, he's got quite a lot of album projects in the works. But he was talking about that and asking about the banjo tuners, and you know, he might try it out on a new guitar as well. So it's definitely it's definitely infiltrating it, and I think that. Obviously, you know, people like Adrian Legg, you know, I've seen, you know, seen plenty of videos of Adrian Legg, and he has them on all six strings, and he has entire songs almost where he's just playing open, you know, sort of Travis picking and then playing the melodies with the tuners almost. And then Nick Harper, yourself, and obviously our mutual friend, Mr. Misko from Russia, who's kind of taken all of the influences like a painter, you know, drawing color from so many different players and kind of sticking it all together on all six strings. And yeah, it's a beautiful thing. And obviously that was a sound that was so unknown to so many people when the Passion Flower thing came out. So it was really cool to see that kind of break into the mainstream somewhat, you know?
I think my approach to it was different than the other guitarists, because my approach to it is probably more influenced by Michael Manring,
who's a bass player,
than it is by any of the guitar players. Yeah. He has so many tunes that use it as well. And it so... He does stuff where he'll manipulate a chord, or he uses a lot of harmonics as well because he's playing bass. So harmonics are a useful, you know, melodic tool
way to get around the neck bass as well. Yeah,
yeah, and also a lot of tapping with it, just because you know he's from the 80s. So, and he uses it in a very particular way that I'm really really into, and. I've gone more and more towards as well so I have a new song called Cocoon, which is probably my most Michael Manring style.
My favorite song, one from the new record. Favorite one from the new record.
Yeah, I think it's probably mine as well. Yeah, I think it probably is. I think I like the way that it's. Do you ever feel when you write something when it's got something that's one of your kind of influences in it? And it makes you feel really nice when you play it because it's just connected to that person.
100% yes. However, for myself, that doesn't always translate to other people enjoying it in anywhere near the same way. Like there's some songs I have that are my absolute favorite things to play, and I want to play them at every show in such a selfish way. But you know, sometimes, well, let me put it this way: the audience will always get it in the moment. But in terms of the translating it into content, you know, it doesn't tick the current content box. You know, I'm talking about things like taking Michael Hedge's influences, but instead of from the na-na-na-na-na-na kind of side, which a lot of people do, it's from the dirge side and the flat picking side.
Yeah.
That doesn't translate into online stuff, but I have a song called Encomium, and I was playing that on tour opening for Tommy, and Tommy would just like walk into soundcheck and say like, "That's my favorite song in your set. It's love that tune," you know, and it would work.
It's got a depth of sound which you can lose yourself inside when you're in that situation of a gig, whereas in you know what it can be like online.
If you don't grab their attention in 5 seconds, then no one gives a shit.
But it's not true. I mean, people do give a shit. People do give a shit. It's just they give it. Just
there's internal voice.
Fewer people give a shit. Yeah, I just ignore it. I don't care about that. So
that's exactly what I was talking about. Yeah,
I care about it financially, but that's honestly the only level on which I care about it. I want as many people to watch my music as possible, but then or hear it.
Watch, you know, watch my said, music. Watch. Yeah,
exactly, exactly. That's because that's what, you know, that's what we're creating is mostly video for online. But what I'd really like is just people to kind of, you know, actually love it, really, which you might not. I think somebody loving something once for like 60
the wow
seconds
factor, yeah,
is not that rewarding.
That's exactly
for us, really.
Exactly why I miss gigs, man, because it was always, and I've said this to so many people, the songs that you play at a gig that move people to tears and the ones they come up to the merch table and they're like, which album was that song that you played on? They're never the hit songs online. You know,
yeah, it's true.
You know,
true.
It's the 7-minute ballads, you know, or, you know, I mean, for you, what's, I mean, you have a lot of what I would call hits in your repertoire at this stage, you know, certainly as a long time fan myself. I mean, which are the standout live tracks for you? I mean, obviously current
live
album
tracks
excluded.
So
because
things that are really good to play, like there's, I mean, there's different reasons. So I really love playing. There's a song called Everything, which is really weird, which I really expected nobody to like.
That's your mega prog epic, dude.
Yeah, it is. But it's also really incredibly cathartic. I mean, by the end of that song, I am always on the... At the end of that song, I am always on the floor, like without doubt, like literally. Mm. I will be on the ground. And it's so kind of viscerally like cathartic. And it's funny because it's not about me, that song, although maybe it is about some kind of darkness that lurks inside every human psyche, because it's about obsession. It's about being obsessed with somebody in a scary way. I think we all do have the propensity to have that, you know, especially if you like you have unrequited feelings or whatever, that can happen. But yeah, the song's quite sinister and kind of, I don't know, that dark, just getting that darkness out or whatever it is, it really seems to feel really, really good. And people get quite overwhelmed by that as well. It's not a song that's going to bring people to tears. It's more like just, there's a lot of builds and like,
it's a journey. It's
just
a journey.
It's hard work. I always introduce that song every single time. I say pretty much the same thing. I say, so this next song, it's pretty weird and it's extremely dark and it's very complicated. Has lots of time signature changes and stuff like that. But don't worry, because it's also extremely long. That's my whole introduction, which I can say in about 3 languages.
That it is. Yeah, oh, the good old introduction. Such an important and underrated part of a singer-songwriter / instrumentalist set.
I used to write them. And that was a lot to do with Nick Harper. Yeah, I used to basically compose introductions for songs, because I noticed going to see Nick Harper that he would say pretty much the same thing before every song, the same. On different gigs, because I went through a phase of going to see him, you know, I'd go and see him 5 shows on the same tour, and he would say the same stuff. And so I thought, you know, either by accident or design, he's basically composed little introductions to the song, and they were really good and really just took you into the world a little bit before you played it, or they were funny, or, you know. So yeah, I used to actually write them, and I've been thinking about whether I should do that for the new album. But what that's kind of evolved into for me is basically YouTube video descriptions, which is an odd thing, but when I post a new song on YouTube, the video description now will have me talking about what the song is about as if I was introducing the song on stage.
Yeah.
So, that's kind of evolved into something. And then in the special edition of the new album, it's got all of these long stories about each song, and it's really nice, that connection that you can get with an audience just from the conversation.
What you're saying about seeing Nick, it's very similar to my relationship with Justin Hayward, who I session for from the Moody Blues, because each song, you know, the set will change, but he will have very specific introductions, almost down to the word, for these songs. And the reason for that isn't due to the lack of spontaneity or the desire to be spontaneous. It's because it gets to the scale with the production where there's, you know, certain cues and things that need to happen for the lighting guy and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, the sound guy switching scenes. And, you know, you can't just have the one man show flexibility with a production like that. But I do that myself. And I released a song, just a little single, probably about a year ago, almost to the day. With a completely stupid name, simply so I could introduce it and just
Shatner's. I forgot what it is. Quite long. William Shatner's pants.
Yeah, it's called William Shatner's pants. And it's
do you want to hear a story about William Shatner?
Well, no. This. Well,
I have a really good true story about William Shatner. Go on. Just let me do it. This guy called Paco Arango. He's a movie director in Madrid, and I did a couple of gigs for him, like private charity gigs. Anyway, so he was once in Newark Airport near New York, right?
And, New Jersey.
It was snowing, and all the flights were getting cancelled. And he was kind of looking up at the board, and flights getting cancelled one by one until eventually, and the airport is slowly emptying. There's nobody left there until his is the only flight left on the board. And by this point, where he is at the little gate that he's at in the airport, there's three people. There's him sitting there looking at the board. There's the person behind the counter, and there's William Shatner, and that's it. And so he really wants to go up to speak to William Shatner because he's a big Star Trek fan, but he doesn't have the courage. So in the end, their flight gets cancelled. He goes up to the counter and gets booked into a hotel. Then William Shatner does the same thing, and then they just kind of walk off, and Paco still doesn't have the courage to speak to him. And in the end, William Shatner goes into the bathroom, so they kind of split ways. But then Paco thinks, well, he's going to come out of there and walk this way. So if I double back now, we're going to cross paths, and I'll just say something. So he doubles back. So this completely empty airport, just these two people slowly walking down a long corridor towards each other. And as they pass each other, Paco looks at Shatner, and he just says, "Captain." And Shatner turns to him and he just says, "Asshole."
Well, that's because he just spent the past 10 minutes doing a captain's log.
Anyway, I think that's an amazing story. And like me, Paco was just delighted. Like, if that happened to me, I'd be so happy that William Shatner would call me an asshole. Because do you know what I mean?
Yeah, he doesn't have a reputation of being a particularly friendly guy. But, you know, the point of the whole William Shatner's pants thing is obviously, as a Brit with the British vocabulary, it's a bit of a double meaning, isn't it? But other people, especially in Germany, they have no idea what that is. And I find that objectively funny. But also, it's just because in a set, you can inject this short little number, and I give it this really long build-up about what we were talking about, you know, about how songs have this deep meaning and everything's really, really crafted. Nice. And it goes on and on and on and on and on.
That's really good.
And then, you know, with that being said, this song's for William Shatner's pants, straight in, you know.
In a set
when you've got to vary the emotional response.
Is it
response,
about his pants? Which particular aspect of his pants would you say that you capture with the music? Would you say it's a visual thing or more the aroma? Kind of how you imagine the fragrance or
It's the captain's log. Honestly, it was a bet. Our sound man on the Justin Hayward tour, I was writing this song on the bus, and he was like, "Oh, sounds good, man. What are you going to call it?" And I said, "I don't know. What should I call it?" And he goes, "William Shatner's pants." I was like, "All right." And he goes, "No." I was like, "Yeah, sure."
William Shatner, the thing is, there's no way William Shatner wears underwear. Absolutely no chance.
There's no underwear in space, John. That's a fact.
In space, no one can hear you, I don't know, insert whatever joke you want at the end of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, slight tangent from the Star Trek and space stuff. We've got to talk about Wilma and then the transition from Wilma, because Wilma, for those unaware and uninitiated, Wilma,
I don't know what I've got behind me,
has been John's. Oh, is she around?
Wilma.
John's faithful axe
Wilma's
for
in
many
a case.
Years.
Wilma's in a case.
So no, you've destroyed,
I've got a couple of guitars
here.
I've got a prototype here. Shit. This is a prototype of the Ibanez, but it's
nice.
I mean, it doesn't even have like the correct logo, like placement and stuff. And it's a really, and you can see the sound hole rosette is just like a white, black and white lines, because we hadn't designed one yet.
Yeah.
But this is a really nice one, actually. This one is thermo-aged spruce and mahogany back and sides, mahogany neck. Because we built loads with different, at this stage in the prototype development, we were deciding what to make out of, basically. So woods and finishes. And this one came out really nice. And this was I nearly went for this wood combination.
Which type of spruce was it? Sorry,
it's called it's Sitka, but it's thermo aged, so it's torrefied. Or do you know about that?
Yeah, is that the same technique that Taylor use?
Yeah, it's a similar thing. I think. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know exactly what Taylor do, but basically you bake the wood.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's called roasted or baked. Ibanez have their bespoke, you know, patented exact system for doing it.
Sure.
Which they call thermo aging, and it's done in a kiln. So basically, they cook the wood, and it dries out the wood in a way that would normally take a couple of decades to do. And I remember it was at a little tiny guitar show in Germany, and there was some Ibanez guitars there, and they looked really nice for the price. So I picked one up, and it was like a kind of standard Dreadnought thing that was not expected, like €200 or something. And I'd noticed the color of the top. It looked kind of old. And I was like, this is definitely spruce. It's not cedar, but it really looks, you know, sun-kissed.
Yeah.
And I thought I'd try it. And instantly, this guitar, it reminded me of an exact guitar a friend of mine has, which is a 70s Yamaha Dreadnought. And they tend to be quite well-made, and they've aged really well and held together really well. And so there's a few kind of 70s Yamaha Dreadnoughts knocking around. And they sound amazing, partly because they're so old and they've... aged really well, and that's what this guitar sounded exactly like. And it's like, how can this guitar sound like it's, you know, 30 plus years old? And it's just because it's been cooked. The top's been cooked. So on my guitar, we've cooked we've thermo aged the soundboard and the bracing, which were all made of spruce. And we tried using a thermo aged maple neck, which is a thing which some companies, big companies, are doing at the moment, because if they would normally have a mahogany or rosewood neck on, say, and a famous electric guitar from the southern states of America, but those woods are quite expensive now, they'll use a maple wood, and which is good for necks, but then they'll bake it so it goes dark brown, basically. Yeah. So it looks like those traditional woods.
Yeah, it's, okay. It's nice.
But yours are different. Yours are done for a reason. Anyway, so I tried it, but it didn't really work with the acoustic to me, because what I was looking for was more rigidity in the neck so it doesn't bend when you change tunings.
Right.
But I measured it, and the difference in pitch change between that and the five-piece mahogany neck that we've ended up using was absolutely, like, immeasurably small, and it didn't sound as good. It added a lot of treble to the sound.
So we
didn't use it. Yeah, it really did.
Well, I know you hate treble.
Quayle had warned me. I don't hate treble. I just it wasn't in a nice way. It wasn't nice sparkly treble. It was you know, the kind of it was like a tacky treble that probably sounds awesome on your Strat over there, but it didn't really work. And I also found some weird stuff, like, it's actually the sides of the guitar make a massive difference to how stable the guitar is when you change tuning. It's bizarre. So when you relax the sides, in terms
of the wood or the wood or the physical depth.
So whatever makes them structurally rigid. So it could be anything. So a denser wood, which is what we've used, a really dense wood, as it happens, because it sounded really, really good, called Pau Ferro. And sounds incredible, but a really dense wood, or it can be the size of it, but it can be the shape of the curves as well. And so some luthiers are doing a thing called double walling on the sides to make them super, super rigid. And we didn't feel we needed to do that because we were using this particular wood anyway, which is really, really dense anyway. So. Yeah. Anyway, that was really technical there, but it's interesting to us.
We could talk about the technical stuff forever, and I love it. And honestly, like, it's been a thrill seeing Ibanez get really involved. I mean, shout out to the Ibanez guys.
This is the black one, which is what it's going to be with the Pau Ferro sides. Yeah. Although that's a different finish than will be on the final model that people can buy. I've put some scratch pads on this one just for experimenting. Oh.
You got them with the old scratch pads.
I think I sent them. I think I sent them actually a picture of. I think I didn't send it. I printed it out for my friend Gordon, who did the scratch pads for me. I think your guitar was one of the ones I printed out a picture of so he could see what the fuck I was talking about, because he'd never seen them before.
That's awesome. Well, that's nice, man. And honestly, I've got to try out these guys. I mean, Ibanez have been there's very few. I would call them mainstream guitar brands, you know, household main guitar brands such as Ibanez and whatever. I mean, there are many. Historically, for those unaware, the fingerstyle community was typically.
It is a community. It is a community.
It is. It really is a community. It is a community. But I mean, it's typically. Yeah, it's filled with empty bottles, if we're talking about Andreas Kunz, you know, empty German Weizenbier bottles. But with a beautiful smell as well. They always smell great, these workshops. It's all the glue.
They do, yeah.
You know, that's because acoustic guitars, you know, versus, say, electric guitars, where the pickups are so much more important to the sound of the instrument, that, you know, getting the right woods, the right tone woods, the body, the sides, everything, the top, makes such a radical difference to the sound of a guitar. And when you're playing unaccompanied and acoustically and you know, unplugged, you really want the finest quality materials and craftsmanship. However, Ibanez, as a big mainstream company, seem to be, from all anecdotes, and I've spoken to them recently myself as well, is that they really give a shit about getting it right.
They are doing their best. So, I mean, it's what I found with the process is that, and people have asked me this, it's like, what compromises did you have to make? And I come from, like, having a signature model before with a smaller company who make incredible, wonderful guitars. And it's funny because with Ibanez, I haven't had to make a single compromise. There have been things which haven't worked. So I've had ideas which didn't work, but I haven't, that's not me being forced to compromise. It's just they didn't work. So, but they haven't ever said, we can't do that. We shouldn't try that. Whereas with my previous signature model guitar, it was basically just a stock model guitar with my choice of woods. And I tried to innovate with it as much as I could.
There was the interesting soundboard kind of thing with that. I'll give a shout out to the Loudon guys.
I feel really awkward about switching companies. I'm really uncomfortable about it. So I don't know what I should say and what I shouldn't say. But I love Loudon guitars, and I'm always going to do that. And
I've given them a shout out on this before many times. And actually, I fully intend on picking up a Loudon one day, because they were the real introduction to me to the genre, even though I've never owned one. Obviously, the aforementioned Eric Roche and Pierre Bensusan, both Loudon players, and Nick Harper, yeah, and you know, I used to live in, inverted commas, in Downpatrick, Northern Ireland, with my ex who built Loudons. She was doing the bodies for a while.
She did a lot of mine.
Yeah, and yeah. It's a real small world, man, isn't it?
It is. But yeah, so I remember when I phoned, I told the general manager first that I was leaving Loudon to go and work with somebody else. And, you know, then I said, you know, is it okay if I tell George? So George Loudon, who's the, you know, the founder of the company and designer of the guitars, or do you want to tell him? And so I waited, you know, like a week or so. And then I phoned George, and I was really kind of nervous about doing that. Not because he would ever be, you know,
it's like breaking up a relationship.
It was really, really painful. I found it really, really painful. He was so kind. And do you know what he said? He just said, you can come back anytime, you know, which was the nicest thing. That was the nicest thing. It made me feel a lot better, because I felt really guilty. And I didn't feel guilty because, you know, of anything professional, really, because it's a perfectly normal thing to happen. But I just felt guilty because, I don't know, it's a family, and the Loudon company is a little, literally a family. And but I mean, they're doing extremely well for themselves, and they have Ed Sheeran on board.
They have
now,
Ed Sheeran,
so I think they could probably do without me. You know what I mean?
They're all right. They're absolutely wonderful, wonderful people over there, and they make amazing instruments as well. And from a business side, you know, I mean, you've been playing that Loudon. I mean, you've been playing Wilmer since I've known you.
Yeah,
and that
she's
must be what?
Fucked,
I mean, how long
yeah.
were you playing Loud on Guitars? Must be like 15 years or something like that.
No, 20.
20 years, you know?
Years,
so,
yeah,
you know,
years.
Switching, you know, companies to follow your muse, you know, there's nothing in any way odd about that, especially as, you know, I mean, most of my friends with brands, they
it's exactly what you were saying. It's what you were saying about trying to take it mainstream and wanting it to be a thing where I grew up with Ibanez in the 90s being the company that allowed certain styles of guitar to kind of become mainstream. So I always feel like without Ibanez, and this may or may not be true, but my perspective on it at the time was that without Ibanez, you know, maybe Joe Satriani wouldn't have been a thing. Maybe Steve Vai wouldn't have had like a platinum record and stuff. And that's how I discovered a lot of artists was basically their kind of Ibanez endorsement. Yeah. So, you know, Paul Gilbert, oh, he's an Ibanez guy. He must be good.
It's so funny, man. You said it's exactly the same for me with DiMaggio. Same, Paul Gilbert, Satriani, Vai. It's all the same kind of family, you know, and mixing these mainstream companies with these men in sheds, you know, or smaller companies. I mean, like Tone with Amp, who are kind of helping me do this podcast. There's a classic example of, you know, husband and wife company, you know. Really, really, it's really cool. It's really cool to see you working with a company like that on trailblazing with a new.
Well, they've been awesome. It's been so easy. It's been really detailed process. Really, like, I can't believe how much time, how unbelievable amount of time, like in terms of like how it's been like 3 years in development and also just the amount of work that's gone into it. And sometimes they put a load of work into an idea and then we try it and it's like, it didn't work. And I feel terrible. I have to email
bad,
and
yeah.
say, I'm really, really sorry, but it's my fault.
They've sold 1,000 peers, you know, in the email conversation. You'll be fine. Don't
That's
worry
true.
About it.
That's true.
You know, just think of it like that. Think of all the peer Steve Vai guitars they're selling.
But to me, it's really, really exciting. And it came about because I kind of met some Ibanez guys in Germany at Guitar Summit. I don't know if you've done that.
I think I was slightly part of it online this year with Andreas Kunz.
Yeah, it's great.
I hear it's the sort of new European NAM, really.
It's tiny. It's not like that. It's really, really small.
We're spoiled for choice over
to
here,
that.
But yeah.
But it's I absolutely love Guitar Summit. And I'm not really a guitar show guy, as you know, but it's just really small and nice.
What are you talking about? You love big crowds, and loads of people, loads of chaos.
Yeah. So, yes, but I met the Ibanez guys there, and I just asked them if I could just, you know, play the Joe Satriani signature model with the Sustainiac pickup on it, because it's just so much fun. So I was just there whittling around on that. And then they were saying, will you try one of our acoustics? Because obviously, you know, I'm an acoustic guy, and I wasn't playing any of them. And I said, I ended up just saying, look, can I talk to you about that? Because I had this conversation where I said, Ibanez to me is the progressive guitar company that changed kind of electric guitar in the 90s at the time when guitar playing was changing and becoming way more technically like interesting and experimental and progressive. And I really think Ibanez should be the brand that does that with acoustic guitar. And I wish you were. And, call me when that happens. And it was like, okay, I'm never going to speak to those guys again. Because to be honest, I was worried that I'd been quite, it was a bit rude of me really, but I really honestly felt that I really love Ibanez as a brand. And I used to get the catalog when I was a kid and, you know, it'll be always the guitar that I pick up in a guitar shop.
Yeah.
And and then I just got an email a couple of weeks later saying, oh, we'd really like to talk to you about your ideas. So then they flew over from Japan to Saltaire, where I live, in my little village.
For the benefit of the international listeners, could you explain where in the UK that is?
So it's in a place called Yorkshire, which is in the north of England, in a place called the Yorkshire Dales. So I'm right on the edge of a city called Bradford, and it backs into, if anybody's ever read Wuthering Heights, that was written like a couple of miles from here, about the bleak Yorkshire landscape. So it's a bit like the Highlands of Scotland, if you can imagine what that looks like, except it's way better. So they came here and I'd emailed them like 8 pages of notes of like guitar design ideas, eight pages of notes. And I thought, this is either going to terrify them or they'll be really pleased. And I was really worried about that. And then when they flew over and we went to a restaurant or a cafe and to have our first meeting, and they all got out their printouts of the notes with all, and that all these designers had all written loads of questions and things, and the, and it was like, yes, this is going to be really, really good. This is going to be a great experience.
I've recently been doing some consultancy for some pedal companies, actually. And more notes, more better, basically.
Yeah, you know? I'm interested in the quad cortex. I haven't got one yet because they've had fulfillment issues because of COVID with all their, I don't know if it was a Kickstarter or what, but they had loads of people pre-invest.
I got one and, in upstairs right now.
Oh, fuck you.
In its box, man. Oh, in its box. Asshole. I haven't opened it yet.
You haven't opened it? Send it to me, you bastard. My friend Tom, I'm friends with Tom Quayle, who lives like a mile from me, and he gets everything sent to him. In fact, I think they engraved his with his name.
Oh, maybe they did that. I'll have to check. I'll be really disappointed now.
I'm going to be so pissed off with you.
I'd love it if it said to John. Oh, that's my camera gone. There we go. That's all right, because for anyone watching on YouTube right now, you're about to see the... because it looks like my DSLR's just run out of battery.
It'd be so amazing if
we're going to go FaceTime.
You've just been replaced by somebody else.
There we go.
Now there we go.
The bright whitewashed... Man. The bright whitewashed... room with the iMac camera that hasn't been updated forever, because I don't know what Apple are thinking, how they can make such great material, but
don't be ashamed of your
awful.
Don't be ashamed of your tragic hovel.
I'm such a southerner, John.
Dude, it's nice to see a bit of squalor. No, it looks nice in there. It looks really nice.
Well, I got a new house. Looks really good. That's the thing. Like, I know. My prison during this pandemic. So the least
great you could get in there. It looks really good. I love your sofa there. I dread to think what's happened on that sofa.
Hey, it's brand new. It's every house in England needs a Chesterfield, man. Come on.
Is that really a Chesterfield?
Of course it's a Chesterfield.
Is that a thing? Wow.
Well, you know, I've got the Persian rug beautiful. And the Chesterfield, right? And the GIK acoustic panels, which are very, very, very important. But the rest of the house is not done up.
Did I put you onto them?
No. My buddy George Lever did. But they're great.
Literally, like Dave, who runs GIK... used to be in bands around Leeds. I've known him for 20 years, and all my panels are GIK. Yeah.
Hey, impromptu shout out to GIK. Yeah, they're great.
Dave Shevin. Hi, Dave.
And actually,
I'll tell him to watch.
yeah. Please do. And actually, Petri Saviola, who I was talking to yesterday, he was also kidding his waiting for his GIK panels to arrive.
Oh, it's so exciting! I'm really gutted that's not because of any of my connections, though, because I feel like I've let him down there. But
dude. Well, I'm sure.
Dave's got this amazing little factory in Bradford. I've just has people there making panels all day, and I've been in there and watched them do it.
Yeah, they're great. I've got plenty. Mine. Yeah, I've got plenty of them, and it's allowed me to record a few things in this room, you know, because obviously new house, just barren walls, you know, and it really works. I've got a couple of nice, sexy kind of ab fuses behind the monitor here as well. But dude, speaking of recording, I just want to touch on something, another thing, which is the new record. It's your first record of, I mean, this would be your fourth album, if I'm not mistaken. Hypertension, Secrets, and if you count Hypertension, I don't know if you do. Do you?
No, I do. I don't. I have a little kind of intermediate live one that's like I just wanted to re-record some songs, basically. So I did that. I did a load of YouTube videos for old songs and released the audio as an album. That's called Live in the Acoustic Asylum.
Oh, yes.
So it's kind of my fifth album, but it's fourth. Proper album,
fourth studio album, yeah. Well, this one is your first one that's actually available on Spotify, because I know for a long time, I mean, we probably share the same opinion on Spotify and that kind of world.
Yeah.
But it's nice to
it's
see
really,
your,
really fucked.
Your stuff
what
up
a lot
there.
Of people don't know about Spotify, because there's a lot of people talk about it and how shit it is for artists. But what a lot of people don't know about it is that when they did their deals to arrange licensing. The music of the major labels, which is like four or five big, huge corporate labels, record labels in the world. I mean, they're not really
Sony,
record labels,
Universal,
but
Universal,
exactly. When they did that deal, they gave shares to those companies as part of the deal. So those major record labels are huge major shareholders in Spotify. So they make money either way. It doesn't really matter to them where the money goes. If Spotify get it, they get their money as shareholders. If it goes to the artists, they get their 50% as rights holders. So they can't really lose. And it does piss me off a little bit when I hear major label artists complaining about Spotify. So it's like, guys, just talk to the owners of Spotify, who's oh, your record label, actually talk to those guys and, you know, tell them that you're not getting enough money, because then it'll change. It won't change if you just keep just hassling Spotify, because as anybody who's ever tried to deal with a major tech corporation for any reason, you know, anybody has a problem with Facebook, you know, who wants to, you know, contact customer services or talk to somebody at Facebook.
Incredibly helpful and easy.
A brick wall of nothing. It's like they deny anybody exists who works there, you know. It's really weird.
Well, the other thing about Spotify, and that, I mean, obviously, you know, I am telling people that you can absolutely go and listen to both myself and John on Spotify and follow and enjoy the musical offerings up there. But something you may not be aware of as a listener as well is that if you say pay for Spotify Premium, and you're paying your whatever it is a month, $9.99, $7.99, or whatever it is, and you only listen to John Gom for that month, your money is not all going to John Gom. And this is something that a lot of people aren't aware of. You know, you could never listen to Mariah Carey, but some of your money might end up going to her and not to the artist that you love. And that's the way it's structured right now, which I think is grossly unfair. It's a strange situation, you know, losing the concerts and then having time to look more into that, what we would consider our passive revenue beforehand, and then, for myself anyway, then going into it forensically during the pandemic and thinking, oh, hang on a second, this is bullshit.
Yeah, it's really bad. And Spotify are worse than others. They're not. They don't all have the same model, and Spotify are particularly shitty. And it's the best and most popular platform from the user's point of view. And you know, I've got a Spotify account because I have to have one for work. I don't need to have the other accounts, but if I don't really have a Spotify account, it's hard for me to do some of the stuff that I need to do on Spotify. So it's really fucking
it's but we are recording this on Friday, just before this episode comes out, because this episode's going to get quickly edited and come out this coming Monday, and it's what's called Bandcamp Fridays, which is the first Friday of every month, where Bandcamp...
Yeah, you can get my new album on there. You'd have to go to my record label called K-Scope, and if you go to their Bandcamp, then you'd be able to get my new album on there. But just buy physical stuff as well. If somebody wants to buy... You know, my new album, you can get all over the world. Get it on Amazon.
It comes with its own message.
There's vinyl.
Comes with its little message there.
They all say to Mike, love you, dude, Uncle John. Imagine if they did. But there's a deluxe edition that I mentioned before. There's a vinyl version. If you go on my website, you can get T-shirts and ship all over the world. And it's really good if people spend money.
They even ship to the EU.
Yeah, backwater. That forgotten backwater.
It's amazing. I had to go to the post office the other day and pay customs on my own CD getting returned because they didn't want to pay customs on it in Germany. It's an interesting situation to get ironed out over here. But yeah, absolutely. Buy from the artist. Sign stuff. My mum still posts my merch over here, except for the US.
I know she does. That's really, really nice. My wife still does it, even though she's not my manager anymore. She continues to do that for me, thankfully. And it's really, really helpful to have somebody doing that for you because it's you know, it's a quite a lot, quite a painstaking little job, you know.
It is. But we love our families and we respect them and we're very, very grateful for that. And these you know, instrumentalists and independent artists, we do run, we try to keep things very close to home. So if ever anyone does go onto a website and say pick up a signed CD or a shirt or even a anything physical, then it does become sort of part of the family almost, and it is special and it is appreciated, and that's why a lot of stuff from people like John and myself, we don't put them on Amazon. I mean, your label may have put your latest record on Amazon.
My new stuff is on Amazon. Yeah, my new stuff is on there. I did used to put my own stuff on Amazon myself, just and actually send stock to Amazon. And it was a really stupid way of selling stuff. It was, I got way way less money. Had to get shipped twice, so it's really environmentally not good. I'd just ship it to them, then they ship it to whoever, and loads of stuff will get damaged. So it's really crap. I mean, the reason Amazon's good from a consumer point of view is really different to the reason why it might be good for the world. Unfortunately, I'm kind of all in favor of breaking these things, breaking these companies up into little bits, like forcing them at least to be national entities. Make them pay tax and stuff,
and pay workers.
Yeah, that'd be nice, so they're replacing them all with robots.
So, well, there's some new content for a new album in the future there about that. But man, thank you so much for coming today. It's nice to chat to you before I let you depart. Well, I won't, because when I stop recording, we should have a little banter briefly.
Yeah, what time is it?
Oh yes, you have to.
Oh yeah, I'm okay. I've got a few minutes here. Yeah.
Pick up the wee one from school or daycare or whatever.
I do pandemic life. Yeah.
Let's do one last question, and it'll be the cliche weirdest gig experience. You've got to throw down one tale. Now, I know you've done a lot of gigs, and I've been privileged to hear of some particularly interesting stories from your gigs. So I know you've got the ammunition.
There's so many. I don't know what I can bring to mind. There's a really old one where I once had to get to the stage from backstage to the stage via a mechanical swan.
Well, I haven't heard that before, and that sounds freaking amazing.
That's pretty weird. So it's because the stage was on a pagoda type thing in the middle of a lake, and the audience was sitting on the banks of the lake. And to get from the backstage,
I do remember you talked about this.
I was placed in a swan and kind of just driven out.
Tunnel of love.
It was very, very disconcerting. I don't know what other weird gig experiences. It's a strange thing to immediately bring to mind, but just generally falling over. Like, I've had ones where I've been I remember I had played with a broken rib on the Isle of Man, probably one of these, actually. It might even have been this gig that I'm wearing.
The Isle of Man, lots of good memories from playing over there.
Oh my god, there's a promoter there called Jono. I don't know if you ever worked with him. But he's passed away now.
I did. Yeah, he passed away.
He was a really good friend
of
ours. Yeah, it was very, very sad. Yeah, did he? That's, oh god. Yeah, it was just, anyway, he's really, that's why I wear this t-shirt all the time. I really miss him. And I remember on that gig, I bruised a rib or broken a rib a few days before, and I found that I couldn't sing. I hadn't really realized it would be so bad, but I couldn't, if I breathed in too far, it really hurt. Like, it really fucking hurt. And then, so I wasn't breathing in so deeply. And then if you don't breathe in so deeply, you kind of have to push out the breath. When you get to your lungs get empty, you start squeezing, and then that would really, really hurt. So I had to actually kind of stop during the gig and just say, look, I'm really sorry. I just need to take a minute. I'm in real pain here. And people were just bringing me brandy on stage. And then somebody brought me some, there was a guy who had multiple sclerosis in the audience, and he brought me some of his painkillers.
Wow.
To the stage. So I had, I was drinking brandy. I was washing down tramadol with brandy on stage, and I was fucking gone by the end of the gig. I was absolutely out of my mind, just completely
baked
flying.
And roasted, just
no
like
pain.
Your guitar.
Absolutely no pain in my ribs whatsoever. But yeah, it was pretty gone.
Beautiful. Well, hopefully you can come back and gig soon. And we got to gig together again soon. It's been a while since we've done anything together.
Yeah, definitely. Yep.
I can't remember when
when
we would have last shared a stage or an event, probably like the London Guitar Show or something like that.
Yeah. Well, I've got a tour booked, so if it happens, so that starts in October, and I'm reasonably optimistic about that. So if you want to come and play, you're always
welcome.
Yeah, man.
I think you're hitting the Thekla, right, over here in Bristol.
Mm. Yeah, the ship, the weird metal ship.
The boat. Oh, it's great. You play underwater because the actual stage is below the water level. It's pretty amazing.
Is it? I didn't know that. That's weird.
It's a good time over there. Yeah, man. I'll come down and we can jump up and do Gloria together or something like that. That'll be fun.
It'll be really nice. I would love it.
Well, johngom.com, Uncle John, who once saw me vomit mustard next to a skip in Bath. It's been a pleasure to see you again. And thanks for taking the time for the podcast here with the Tone Winamp guys and the new album. Here I am. I feel like a radio DJ or something. The faintest
idea. If anybody's still watching, by the way, if you've got to the end of the video, post a comment underneath that just says, I watched till the end. And I will like or reply to that comment.
John will comment and subscribe.
Anybody who's watched
till
the end, because we're alone, it's a pandemic. I really want to see your little avatar face.
John misses your avatar face. We all miss you, and we all hope to see you all at concerts soon. John Gomp, thank you so much, man. Stick around.
Cheers, Mike.
And let's have a little chin wag before you have to go. Lots of love, everyone. JohnGomp.com. Bye-bye. Hey guys, thanks so much for checking out this week's episode of the podcast. For more information about this week's guest, head to the link in the description, where you will also find more information about the Tonewood amp, as well as that cheeky little discount you can get as well. Lots of love. See you next time.